It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. College students don't effectively prioritize sleep. Actually, says our next guest, they don't prioritize sleep much at all. And schools don't really help. The 24-hour libraries encourage cramming, not sleeping. But Roxanne Pritchard says that if you are nervous for tomorrow's test, the best thing you can do is sleep. Pritchard is a professor of neuroscience and psychology and scientific director of the Center for College Sleep at the University of St. Thomas. Welcome, Roxanne.
Thank you for having me.
Why should we pay? You know, I listed when I did our intro a few minutes ago all the things that we tell college students. We tell them to not drink too much. We tell them to not drink and drive, not text and drive. Make sure that you're studying. You're not partying too much. I mean, these are all very, very, very important things. But sleep, you say sleep is just as important and can impair you just as much as those other things.
Absolutely, and that's what our research shows. More and more, we're having a better understanding of what the purpose of sleep is for the brain and how much sleep promotes good brain health and brain restoration and learning. So we're seeing that for many teens and young adults, they're walking around in a crisis state of sleep deprivation that's impacting many, many aspects of their mental health and their performance.
And so what should we be paying attention to? How much sleep should college students be getting?
That is a good question. So when we're talking with students about sleep, we try to get across that there's three main aspects to sleep to pay attention to. Well, number one is the quantity. And a lot of people don't realize that teens still need at least 8 to 10 hours of sleep, including young adults. Mm. And most people haven't gotten that since elementary school, frankly. So students are kind of walking around numb or accustomed to the effects of sleep deprivation and don't know what it feels like to get good sleep. So good sleep, when you get enough sleep, you wake up naturally. You don't need an alarm clock to wake up. Mm. And for most young adults, it's going to be 8, 9, even 10 hours of sleep. Oh, I was going to say the second thing we want to think about is just the consistency and the importance of having the same schedule on weekdays and weekends. And if you're going to bed at, say, 2 a.m. on the weekends but 11 p.m. on the weekdays, that's the equivalent of flying to New York to San Francisco every weekend in terms of its jet lag. So we also talk about the importance of having a consistent sleep schedule.
So I'm going to assume that college students don't schedule 7 a.m. classes, but some of them do, and some of them have practices and things like that. Some of them are doing things even earlier than that. How do you their regular sleep rhythms may not conform to waking up at 5 a.m. without an alarm clock. What do you tell them?
Right. So we tell them to pay attention to what their body is. So some people find it easier to wake up in the morning people. Some people are definitely evening people. And seeing what they can do to schedule classes later in the day if they are evening people. We also are working with universities to make sure that students who have sleep disorders, including delayed phase sleep disorder, are registered through disability services so they get something like priority registration so they can make sure that there's a spot for them in later classes. So unfortunately, it's often the freshmen who have the worst sleep of all who get stuck with the earliest classes because those are the only classes left to sign up in.
That makes sense. A lot of college students will get, as you know, 4 to 6 hours sleep, whatever they can get during the week, and then they will sleep like 12, 13 hours during the weekend. Is that good?
No, that's not good. I mean,
you can't catch up on sleep.
Okay, but you can't really catch up on sleep. You can maybe make up 40% of the sleep you're missing. But the problem with that is if you sleep till noon or two on the weekends, that makes it hard to fall asleep at a reasonable time Sunday night, and that makes Monday morning really rough. So what we do is we kind of work and think about how we can maximize the weekday sleep so you don't have that big crash on the weekends. And sometimes that involves talking with coaches, seeing if you really need that 5:30 a.m. swim workout, or could you kind of change the schedule around?
That is true. So if you can't catch up, and if you have to do the 5:30 a.m., you just have to go to sleep early. I mean, that's kind of it's the burning the candle at both ends issue here, right?
Right. Although biologically, a lot of teens have shifted, so it's physically impossible for those to go to bed early. So a night person who is used to going to bed at 1 a.m., if you ask that person to try to go to bed at 10, will just be sitting, lying down, not being able to fall asleep. So it takes your body about a day to shift 1 hour from your regular schedule. So there's a limit to how much kind of finagling you could do with your schedule.
So it strikes me that what you're saying is that society has to accommodate the sleep habits and patterns of college-age kids, not college kids, accommodating what they need to do to get their stuff done.
I say both and, right? So one of the things we do at the Center for College Sleep is we provide a toolkit called College Sleep Environmental Scan that can help universities look at their programming and policies and structures to think about what changes they can make to improve the environment, to make it a healthy sleep environment. So nowadays, a lot of the homework is due online, and if professors click just end of the day, that means midnight. So that would kind of be a factor that universities could change. Right now, if something's due at midnight, that means you start your other homework after that one's due, right?
Right.
So this is just one of the small policy changes that universities could make to help the sleep environment. Meanwhile, students can work on sort of valuing and prioritizing sleep, and a lot of that is going to be changing relationship with electronics.
Which keeps us up at night, which...
Oh, absolutely.
It's better to have a light on and read than it is read a physical book in your hands than to read an electronic book.
It depends on the color temperature of the light. So, blue wavelength light can what it does is suppresses your melatonin, so it makes it harder. That's a hormone that tells your body it's nighttime. It makes it harder to fall asleep if you have that blue light, whether it's from a light bulb or from an e-reader. So if you have sort of filters on your electronic devices like Night Shift on the iPhones, that can sort of diminish the effects of that stimulation. But often it's not necessarily a book. It could be more like video game or texting or something that is engaging people. And part of that is just the excitement, the cognitive arousal. From the game like Fortnite or something is going to last and make it harder for the brain to wind down and fall asleep.
So college students, there are a number of factors that they have to consider. We have about a minute left. There is the studying part, there's the sleeping part, and then there's the engaging with friends part. And the engaging with friends is the thing that kind of backs people up. Suddenly it's 9 o'clock at night and they have to study and they're up for another 3 or 4 hours.
Right. And you know, college is a really exciting time when you want to start forming relationships and exploring who you are. So it's hard to ask people to give that up. And what we do at the Center for College Sleep is ask universities to think about what kind of programming can we do on Saturday morning and Sunday morning that provides you social opportunities too. They're not always late at 2 a.m.
We have been talking about the importance of sleep with Roxanne Pritchard. She is a professor of neuroscience and psychology and scientific director of the Center for College Sleep at the University of St. Thomas. Roxanne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next, we'll talk about how teens can protect themselves from dating violence. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Go ahead. Respect your relationships. That's the tagline of a new interactive website and outreach initiative aimed at teenagers and dating. The idea, called Dare to Know, or D2K, is intended as a challenge and a movement for teens to rally around healthy relationships. The initiative is the brainchild of the folks at End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, whose executive director, Patty Seeger, is with us right now. Patty, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. I really am excited to talk about this campaign.
Cool. I was excited when you told me about it last month, and I'm still excited. So I was going through the website yesterday, and I was struck by two things. First, it's a really, really positive message. You're not saying avoid violent relationships. You're saying create healthy relationships. What's the difference between these two messages?
Well, thank you so much for bringing it up. It seems like in most of my discussions with the media, people want to focus on the violence, which is, of course, important. But really, the foundation is health and healthy relationships and respecting yourself, respecting others, respecting the person who you want to be in a relationship with. And that is the counterbalance to an unhealthy relationship, right? So if we get folks thinking about what are the characteristics of a happy, healthy relationship, we think that we can avoid violent relationships altogether.
And what are the characteristics? Talk to me about that. What are the characteristics of a happy, healthy relationship?
Well, I think it needs to be defined by each person, and what we really do is we challenge teens to think about the kinds of characteristics that they value personally and that they would like to see in a partnership. Characteristics like kindness, that respect, dignity, respecting my autonomy, allowing me to make my own decisions and respecting that. Those are the things that many teens and actually adults identify as hallmarks of healthy relationships.
Where do teens get the idea for how relationships work? Do they get it from their parents more, the media more, other kids?
You know, I would say it's really a combination of all things. You know, our culture is just, our media culture is just swamping all of us, teens included, with messages about relationships. I think about how many popular songs refer to particularly women in derogatory terms, sometimes using the B word.
Right.
Even
Prince, I'll be watching you with Sting.
Yeah.
From years and years ago.
It.
Yes.
Yeah, that song by Sting is essentially a stalking song.
It is essentially a stalking song, yes.
And so, you know, even these subtle messages that somehow seem to romanticize stalking, control, jealousy, obsessive love, really paint a picture of normalcy for all of us. What we know is when people are in an abusive relationship, that doesn't feel normal at all. It is absolutely not what people want or enjoy or expect out of a relationship. Yet our media culture, through television, movies, music, portrays a completely different image. And so, you know, we have to think about how do we counter all of that and lead young people to think about what healthy, happy relationships look like that aren't about that obsessive love. Jealousy to that degree is not normal.
We are talking with Patty Seeger. She's the executive director of End Domestic Abuse with Wisconsin. They're running a Dare to Know campaign, which talks about healthy relationships, especially modeling that for teens. Are you a teenager, and have you or do you know someone who has been in an abusive relationship? What kinds of problems did this cause in day-to-day life? How did you or they get out of it, or are you still dealing with it? Were you in a relationship as a a young person that was abusive, and how did that affect you moving forward now that you're older? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org is our email, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. So as I was going through the website yesterday, Patty, I also noted a promo video that says it's hard to know if you're in an unhealthy relationship. Talk to me about that, recognizing that what's going on isn't right.
Right. You know, unhealthy relationships, abusive relationships, don't usually start out that way. They usually start out exactly the opposite. Abusive people use really the romance that people expect from our cultural messages as a hook, really. And so these relationships may start out actually even more romantic. You know, a person who says things, you know, like, I love you like no other. I will never meet another person like you. You're the only one for me. These are messages that we think are really positive.
Right.
In my many years of working with adult victims, I heard from so many people who survived domestic violence who talked about, you know, this person seemed like the perfect partner. You know, he or she even said, quit your job, I will take care of you, 1 week into the relationship. And I would say to them, that's not normal. Most people wouldn't want you to move in with them and have you quit your job, and they will support you fully that quickly. That's just not normal.
Right.
But people think that that's like this person wants to be with me so much. And it's really that person wants to be with you so much. They want to make sure that you're not interacting with others. They cut you off from your friends and your families. It's very isolating. And parents who've had teens who are in abusive relationships experience that as well. They see their teen withdraw in the family. Their teen may start wearing different clothes, become hypervigilant about responding to texts or phone calls from their partner. Mm. So parents also see that shift. They see a dynamic that happens that concerns them. And, you know, parents don't necessarily know what to do about it. And we're really hoping that parents will also go to that website to learn some critical skills about how to respond.
The website is it daretoknow.com? I don't have it in front of me right now.
It's daretoknowwi.com, and the two is the number two.
Okay, dare number so, two, know, KNOWWI.com.
Dot org.
Yes. Daretoknow.org. One of the things, though, that I find interesting is that the parents may see this. Friends may see their friends changing once they start dating somebody, but it's kind of like a frog boiling in water, or, you know, in water that wasn't boiling, that's slowly boiling. You,
right,
in the relationship, don't always recognize it until it's boiling.
Right. In fact, you may be the last person to recognize it. And it's a really hard dynamic for any of us to think about. If somebody starts to try to say to you, you're madly in love with this person, and someone's saying to you, you know, this doesn't feel like a healthy relationship, you're madly in love with that person. So that's not a place where your brain is going to want to go.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know is that most teens in abusive relationships won't even tell an adult. They are very unlikely, in fact, to tell an adult, their parents included. I know that most parents would believe that they have relationships with their kids that they would tell, but and any of us who think about ourselves back in our teen years, we have to remember that we probably wouldn't have told our parents things. There are many things that we didn't tell our parents. So you'll notice on the website we have a teen ambassador program. We're really trying to develop a core group of teens, because what we know, teens won't tell an adult, but they may tell a peer. So we want teen peers to be able to support and educate, be able to identify unhealthy relationships in their friends, and know how and have a skill set to be able to intervene.
So are you giving classes, workshops? How are you reaching out to people? Are you going through high schools around the state?
Well, right now we have a statewide teen council. There are currently 70 teens from across the state, all over the state, who are engaged in meeting regularly. And actually, it was those teens who helped us design this whole campaign, and we're really grateful for them. We additionally host each year a statewide conference on healthy relationships, and that conference has been growing so much so that about 500 people attend it every year, the majority of which are teens, and the teens lead the workshops and the trainings and teach each other. We're with the Teen Ambassador Program, we're hoping to create like a diffuse system of teens across the state who can do engagement in their schools. There are domestic violence programs in all of Wisconsin's 72 counties and in all 11 tribes. And the staff of those programs work really hard to get into the schools to try to provide education.
We will talk more about this in a moment, the problem with that. We are talking to Patty Seeger about a new initiative, Dare to Know, which helps teens recognize domestic abuse and violence and have healthy relationships. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Domestic violence and abuse issues often start early. Abusers usually show signs in their first relationships as teens. And survivors then learn to kind of normalize this unhealthy treatment that they don't necessarily recognize as unhealthy. A new initiative called Dare to Know, D2K, is challenging teens to talk about what healthy relationships look like. It allows teens a chance to recognize potentially abusive behaviors and learn new ones before the behaviors become a cycle. So what do you think family and friends need to do to support a young person who in one of their early relationships may be struggling with abuse? Parents, what is your role in monitoring your teen's relationships? What would you do if you thought or you knew your child was in a physically or an emotionally abusive relationship? Educators, you must see this. If you suspect a relationship between students is abusive, what protocols are in place to help you figure that out and help these students? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is where to email us, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are talking to Patty Seeger of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Patty, as we were heading to break, you were talking about peer-to-peer training, and you started to talk about the problems with that. Talk to me now.
Oh, I was actually talking about domestic violence programs, trying to do education in schools, and one of the biggest problems with that is that many schools feel like it's a topic they don't want discussed in their school. So a lot of schools, many schools allow staff from domestic violence programs to come in and talk with teens. Many don't.
And why not?
Like it's a topic. I think they may feel like it's a topic that's too risky, but, you know, I think if we frame things in the healthy relationships frame rather than abusive relationships, I think that may be a little bit more palatable. I think one of the, you know, I don't think there's any age that's actually too young for us to be talking about concepts of kindness and respect.
Right.
You can have that conversation with a four-year-old. It doesn't even have to be about a relationship, like an intimate partner relationship, but it can be about your relationship with other humans in your life, right?
Brother, sister, so, yes.
Brothers, sisters, your classmates, you know, setting children and then youth up for understanding core characteristics like kindness and truthfulness, integrity, treating others with dignity. Those are not threatening concepts at all in my mind. And in anything, if anything, they create positive, healthy children, youth, adults.
So let's talk about the nature of dating violence, especially for teens. We see teens, they're 16, 17 years old, maybe younger, and they're falling in love for the first time. And I have my doubts about whether that's real love or just puppy love, but it's still a serious thing that they're feeling. And it also can be serious in terms of the abuse.
Yeah, it can be super serious in terms of the abuse. We have certainly at End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, it's not an uplifting report, I will tell you, but we do an annual report on the homicides that happen in intimate partner relationships across the state of Wisconsin. We publish that report annually, and it's available on our website, endabusewi.org. And every single report includes at least one to two teens who have been killed as part of a teen dating relationship. So I don't think, you know, when people look at those relationships, at teen relationships, and they attach words like puppy love to them and sort of minimize them, and if they're not taking seriously, if abuse is happening, I think it's really critical that people rethink that we know that this kind of abusive relationship can, certainly not always, homicide is the most rarely occurring event in abusive relationships, but we do know it can escalate that far.
When we talk about abuse, we are talking about physical abuse, violence, hitting, kicking, what have you. But we're also talking about emotional abuse. We're talking about manipulation, right?
Yeah, controlling, name-calling, isolating the person. On an individualized basis, there's really a pattern of coercion and control that really emerges. And all people who've been victimized by dating or domestic violence really talk about that as the sort of hallmark early things that they noticed, that they were slowly being sort of like the frog in the in the pan of cool water that's got a flame under it. They were slowly being controlled, not realizing it. And a lot of that started out in a way that they deemed normal in that romantic context that we all have. Your partner saying, oh, don't go out with your friends tonight. I want to spend the night together with you watching TV. I'll miss you too much. And, the person thinks, oh, well, this person loves me so much, they just want to be around me. So they cancel their gathering with their friends and hang out with their new partner. Those things don't necessarily always raise alarms for people, right?
Mm-hmm.
They just don't. But over time, what people who are in abusive relationships talk about is feeling isolated and cut off. And when someone's isolated and cut off, they start to lose their perspective. Mm. They are disconnected from resources that may help them. So we really try to encourage people, friends and family, to hang in there. All too often, friends and family will notice that somebody's in a bad relationship and will say things like, you have to get out of that relationship or I'll have nothing to do with you, that just isolates the person further.
So
it cuts off one more avenue for the person to go to.
So if a friend cancels something to do with a friend because he or she needs to stay home with their partner, their new partner, the friends should come over and just take him anyway, right? Drag him out anyway.
Well, I think I don't know if I would do that, but I would say that for friends who notice that pattern, who say, okay, well, this person's no longer our friend. She's obsessed with her new boyfriend, and she's not gonna, she doesn't want to do anything with us anymore. And blah, I would say keep the line of communication always open. Don't ever just abandon a friendship because that person will eventually need you. And it's, you know, it's a very, it's such a subtle thing when people get caught up in abusive relationships. They don't know, and they are madly in their mind and their heart in love with this person. Mm. And they don't know that that's what's happening to them.
You mentioned a few minutes ago something about name calling. We in this culture, we kind of normalize teasing as part of like flirting, and yet this falls into relationship abuse sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. And, you know, it's a really weird thing, you know, and I don't really quite honestly know what to make of it when, you know, when even people, like, if I just talk about women, you know, if I have women friends who refer to their gang of girlfriends as, you know, my B words, you know, and I just think all of that, in such subtle ways, continues to foster. These are not positive words, you know. So, it is a strange thing that's happening in our culture, you know, where you know, people think that this is okay, it's normal. Some of these words are turned into, you know, girlfriend or my pals kind of words. I've even heard men use that kind of terminology with each other, you know. And I don't fully understand how we got there, but definitely that kind of name calling, I think, contributes to the culture.
Before somebody even gets into a relationship, and we're talking about healthy relationships, because I think that once somebody falls over that ledge and they are in love and all of their body chemicals are just kind of raging at this point, they don't necessarily see it. But how do we kind of train ourselves to see it so that at the very, very beginnings, we see those kinds of flags like, I don't want you to go out with your friends. I want you to be with me. We see those kinds of, I want you to quit your job sort of things. How do we train people to see them before they're in the middle of them?
Well, other than saying it, I mean, I just think in, you know, especially when, you know, I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to over my many years who've, like, within, you know, days of being in a relationship, they're moving in with the person. They're, you know, after their first one or two dates, the person's their boyfriend or their girlfriend, and they're referring to that person in those terms. They're not dating. They're in the relationship after mm-hmm. one or two dates. You know, that's really not normal, you know. In a normal, healthy relationship, people spend time getting to know each other. They talk with each other. Ideally, I think people should have early conversations about the characteristics that they value in a relationship.
We're going to talk about those characteristics in a moment. We're talking to Patty Seeger. She's the executive director of End Abuse Wisconsin, which runs the Dare to Know campaign, inspiring healthy relationships, especially in teens. We'll be back in a moment. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. A new statewide initiative called Dare to Know is trying to inspire teens to recognize and talk about healthy relationships. This in the hopes that they won't start a cycle of unhealthy relationships, which can last the rest of their lives. We are taking your calls on this if teens are actually up in the morning. 800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Patty Seeger, it is hard to do a morning show when school is not in and then expect teens to be up any time before 11 a.m.
That is so true. Teens do sleep in late, so it may not be that we'll get a teen to call in today because of that dynamic.
But hopefully traffic will go up to the website. So Talk to me about culture and how culture plays into this. We were talking about this before.
Well, I just think there's a lot of societal norms that support a culture of violence. You know, they're not things, because they're societal norms, we don't necessarily recognize them. They're normal. They're norms. Mm-hmm. But we certainly I will say I want to give a lot of credit to the youth today. I know a lot of adults are scratching their heads and thinking about all of the ways that the youth of today are expressing their gender and getting out of the gender binary. But I will also say that it's gender norms are one of the norms, you know, rigid norms about what a girl slash woman and rigid norms about what a boy slash man should be are contributing norms to gender violence. So I am thrilled with the current generation of teens and youth who are really pushing us to think in so many ways beyond the gender binary, think about, and many of them feel free and are willing to express their gender, not just in terms of sexual orientation, is this child gay or straight, but a number of teens and youth and adults are willing to step out and say, you know what, I don't identify either as man or woman. I would like to be referred to as them or they. And that may seem strange to people, but that breaking down of our gender norms will be, I believe, extraordinarily helpful in our work. And people respecting individuals to live into their lives as their true selves will also really help us to build the kind of respect and healthy relationships that we really need to evolve towards in our future.
Interesting. So gender norms play a role in terms of boys thinking that they need to that in order to be tough and manly, they need to be violent, and women kind of accepting that submissive role.
Well, certainly, they need to never cry or show Boys are taught to never cry or show or express emotion. And that bottles up in humans. You know, humans are emotional beings. And there is definitely, a thing that happens. We see it all the time. A little four-year-old boy falls on the playground, scrapes his knee, and starts crying. And a parent will say, hey, be a big boy. Boys don't cry. Well, that message right there is a message about a gender norm that's happening. And it teaches boys from a young age that they're supposed to bottle up their emotions and their feelings. And girls are more allowed to express their feelings. But then girls also get labeled as emotional. We have these, I think people would like to think that they're not rigid gender norms, but they're tapes that play over generation to generation to generation. You know, our parents pass these words down from generation to generation. I certainly know in my family, my mom said, boys don't cry to my brother. And I know that those things happened. And certainly not all boys. And in fact, the vast majority of boys and men do not grow up to be abusive, despite those gender norms. I do think it does not help the situation.
So talk to me about long-term and short-term effects. If somebody is in an abusive relationship when they are teens, whether they are the abuser or being abused, how does that affect their view of relationships going forward?
Well, obviously, I think I can't say that 100%, someone's teen victim, they will be a victim in adult life, or a teen abuser, they will be an abuser in adult life. But what we do know is those first relationships, intimate partner relationships that we have, as teens really form a critical foundation for relationships into the future. So I don't, I can't definitively say that being an abuser as a teen will mean that you're an abuser as an adult, although that is more likely. And I can't say that being a victim when you're a teen will mean you're a victim as an adult. And I can't say that's more likely in that case. You know, people who are on the victimization end, generally, as most of us would feel, don't feel good. Mm. And they seek to not be in, often seek to not be in an abusive relationship. Again, sadly, because of that dynamic I talked about earlier, where abusers are hyper-romantic at the beginning of a relationship,
right.
They may a person who has been abused may suddenly find this next person, and that person says, "I would never abuse you. I will love you forever."
And that starts the cycle again.
And they find themselves back in that cycle again, and that's the hard thing.
So what we're addicted to...
It's a really seductive thing.
Yeah, what we're addicted to is that sort of hyper-over-romantic feeling that we get from our movies and television and songs.
Yes, yes, I think that's true. So, it's a really strange thing. And, you know, certainly nobody likes being in an abusive relationship. There is no human who likes being abused in that context. So it is not a positive thing for people. It creates lifelong trauma that people have to deal with, can create lifelong trust issues. People can develop anxiety, depression, suicidal thoughts, may engage in alcohol and drug use, where they may have never done that before, but for being in this relationship.
So the minute we have left, I want to talk about if somebody is listening to this, is in an abusive relationship, wants to get help, what do they do?
So I would say if in Wisconsin, if you want to go to our website, endabusewi.org, click on the Get Help link. There are domestic violence services with hotlines. In all 72 counties, all 11 tribes. I will also say there is a national domestic violence hotline with a teen focus. Simply go to thehotline.org and you can connect into a national teen hotline for teen victims of dating violence. Really just get information and find support that way. Getting information and resources are your way out. And in the meantime, go to daretoknow.wi.org and find out, you know, start to explore what a healthy relationship looks like.
So we've been talking to Patty Seeger, who is the executive director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. They've got a program, which she just mentioned, which is Dare to Know, which helps people recognize healthy relationships. That website is dare2wi.org. And also we've got a number that you can call, 800-799-SAFE, if you want help. That is a hotline number. Patty, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me here today.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show, and you are listening to the Ideas Network.